The reason for the hushed tones are that we're in the magnificent State Library of Victoria, just in an anteroom beyond the magnificent domed reading room. I realise I've just said the word magnificent twice, but it's that kind of building. And while we're on the theme of magnificence, I'm joined by the inestimable Kaz Cook. Kaz, tell us about the fellowship that brought you into this library in the first place.
Well, the library offers fellowships every year to any kind of artistic punters who would like to have a go at interacting in some way with the collection here. And it's not just books. There's something called realia, which I thought was regalia, misspelled, but actually means anything inside a library that isn't a book. So because the State Library of Victoria used to be the museum, there's a lot of stuff in the cupboard. And then, of course, donations bring new things in all the time, cultural treasures. So I applied for a fellowship for 3 months. I've got just a few weeks left, and what's come out of it is a blog called Fellow Frockery on Tumblr. And I've been sort of promoting that through my own social media, but also this little exhibition in one of the dome galleries.
So the changing faces of Victoria suggests the ways in which these mementos and items tell us something about a kind of bygone age. We're standing at one of the cabinets, and the backdrop of it is a gorgeous photo of Victorians in their regalia, I guess.
Well, they're toffs. This photo is of, I think it's 1912. This was the mob from Government House going to the Melbourne Cup. So we've got spats, we've got top hats, we've got bow ties, we've got ladies in lace fascinators, which actually makes them look a little bit like their faces have gone mouldy. Really big picture hats on the women. We've got military adjutants with one feather in their hat, which makes it look a little bit like they've just run through the chook yard before they arrived. And that's the backdrop. And then in front, one of the things that I really loved doing this exhibition was, I think all of us have seen those photos of Aboriginal people of the past with sort of curved breastplates hanging around their neck, like a large necklace that might say something like King William. And they were colonial breastplates given to them by the military that was running the different colonies of Australia. And then an Aboriginal artist from the Yorta Nation, Trina Hamm, has made a beautiful contemporary new breastplate, which is more like a title to land of the Murray River area where her people are from. And so what I really like about it is it's the past and the present as well brought together. And Trina actually made this breastplate, which is sort of an etched zinc showing billabongs and the river and with symbols of how she and her family have used the country for thousands of years. So it's made me more interested in history and more interested in what people wear to say who they are, and that's really what this exhibition is about.
It's gorgeous because it's a kind of mirror of your own activity as an artist coming in here being inspired by the historical artifacts. Taking you up on that idea of the things people wear and what they tell us about people, tell us more on that.
Well, I guess it comes from me being a kid who kind of dressed out of the op shop. So I've always been interested in what people wear and how you can fake having more money than you have, how you can develop your own sense of style, and what you can tell about people from what they wear. And so some of the things in the exhibition are gloves. And so gloves started off as a military thing, and then they became something that only rich people could wear. And then they were examples of respectability. So we have some 1950s gloves, which are a little bit grubby, but would have been used to sort of show somebody's status. So there's one glass case with things that go to the idea of status. And then there's a glass case, which is kind of do-it-yourself, the stuff that workers made for themselves, or things like sashes, Michael, came from. They were sword holders. So, you know, our governors general, when they've been boy ones, have usually had a sash to hold their ceremonial sword. And then, of course, the footy teams took on the sash, and that's now part of the official jumpers. And for someone like myself, fascinated by the idea of the beauty pageant and the livestock parade at any agricultural show at which sashes are de rigueur.
I tell you what, both of them much enhanced if they carried a sword in their sash at a beauty pageant.
Yes, it would improve things immeasurably.
So moving along in this cabinet from the magnificent gloves and stockings, tell us about this dance card with the pencil attached, which is just gorgeous.
We have four dance cards. I've always loved that phrase, "My dance card is full." meaning I'm up to pussy's bow, I can't possibly deal with any more young gentlemen. But these were actual dance cards used by a young lady, and when she went to a dance, she would write in the names of the blokes. So it was quite regimented. There were perhaps 8 to 10 dancers, and you'd write in the name, and then that fellow would come and find you and have the dance. These are from the war decade, really, of the Second World War, 1930s. And she kept the dance cards, which is absolutely gorgeous. Her name was Jean Charlton, so I went back through the records. You know, she's written down Jack and Jim and my favourite, Tall Dark. Didn't know his name. I checked the names and I was trying to find out whether Jean had married anybody with a name on the card, and I'm happy to say she didn't, which means her dance card wasn't indeed full.
It's like a cross between Tinder and the little notebook that IKEA gives you with a pencil attached so you can write what you want to purchase. I'm kind of sad for Jean. She didn't marry Tall Dark. He sounds fun.
Well, maybe he did, but he wasn't on the marriage certificate as Tall Dark. So there is a limit to the research you can do about provenance.
Now, what's this bit of fabric we have back here with what looks to be a map of Darwin?
That is a silk escape and evade scarf. It was worn by pilots in World War II in the Pacific. So if you were flying in the Australian Air Force and you had to ditch your plane, or you knew you were going to crash, you'd have to whip your scarf off and have a look at where the fuel dumps were in Milangimbi or just off Darwin, perhaps on one of the Tiwi Islands.
It's not the most practical place to keep a map, is it, or is it?
I reckon it is if you're a pilot, because if you're going to have to jump out of a flaming vehicle and run away, you'd want something that was tied on and looks dashing, frankly.
Hang on, I'm taking my scarf off. I need to see where we are. It doesn't quite have the right ring to it.
Oh, well, I'm not taking you anywhere.
I've got it all printed on my socks. It's the only way I know where I'm going.
Well, we've got a communist sock over here in the other display case. And in my mind, the communist sock was something that I found quite early. It's just a plain sock with the hammer and sickle screen printed onto it in the 1980s. And in my mind, after I found it, it just kept shrinking and shrinking until it was a baby's sock. So when I bought it out, I was a bit shocked at what a clodhopper it is.
I love that your caption in it in the exhibition says, even political activists tend to lose one sock in the wash.
Yes, that is the caption with the most brevity in this exhibition.
So this cabinet, following your class theme from earlier, is a little less dandified than the other one.
Yeah, one of the different micro collections or sub collections, I guess, that I love is pattern books. This book with the fold out arm, it's a fold out, it's not mutton chop whiskers, it's leg of mutton sleeves. There was a lot of mutton in our history, Michael. So it's a fold out pattern, and people would come here and they would jot down their own measurements and do pattern drafting and work out, because in those days there were very few ready-made clothes. So tailors, mothers and all sorts of people would come here and use the books. And this book is a very rare one from the 1890s with that fold-out pattern. And in some of the books you find that people have actually left their measurements so that you can work out what size they were. And this is Enid Gilchrist's maternity wear from the 60s. And I would say that the woman in the lovely emerald green coat that you could buy that magazine for 4 shillings. She has quite the look of the sedated pregnant woman, doesn't she?
I was going to say, she looks incredibly serene. She's enjoying her second trimester there.
She's holding up her silk evening bag with her silk evening gloves. I don't know who she was. I think she was fictitious. And also these enormous pinking shears, which are longer than a school ruler and very heavy, were used in the Flinders Lane rag trade here in Melbourne. And I can just imagine them snicking through some very diaphanous lingerie fabric there.
Kaz, one of the things I love about what's come out of this project is your blog is full of pictures that have caught your eye, and generally people in the past who, through what they're wearing, you've kind of fallen in love with them. How much digging of those stories have you wound up doing?
Well, funny you should say that, because I did find a wonderful picture of a dancer called Ada, and she had one of those Victorian name badges on, so ADA picked out in diamantes across her bodice. Luckily, her name wasn't Marguerite, so she could afford it. But I've tracked her, and I've spent the last year starting with Ada and then the ripples moving outwards. And now I'm writing a novel about her based on her troupe of vaudevillians who travelled around Australia and around the world with all sorts of magicians, and there's a family mystery. And so I'm immersed in that now. So when they kick me out of the library, I'll still be kind of here in my mind.
the old saw about truth being stranger than fiction. I mean, how ridiculous are some of the stories you're uncovering, or how improbable, if not ridiculous?
Well, you know, I've always been a non-fiction writer, and so I love the real stories. The one that I found, and I thought, oh, I wish I'd invented that, but there was a travelling window dresser who came to Australia in the very early 1900s, and he had made all these incredibly elaborate medals for himself and, you know, said that he'd won all these window dressing competitions, and he made these elaborate sort of tableaus in the new department store windows in Melbourne, in places like Myer and in Adelaide. And in Adelaide, he had the gas lights at the front of the windows that you could see from the main street, and all this fabric that was swirling and had fans blowing it everywhere, and it was a woman, and she was on the rocks, and she was representing religion, and there was a shipwreck. And anyway, it caught on fire and burnt down most of the major department store in Adelaide.
Oh, no.
And that's the other great thing, that, you know, you look at these items and then you can put together stories by going to the National Library of Australia Trove website and seeing all the old criminal reports. You can put in anybody's name. So we have this wonderful real and digital archive now, and hopefully we can hold on to it as libraries move into the future, that it won't all be about being able to go to the library and plug in your Wi-Fi, that there will still be professional librarians who understand what's in the collections and can help us see them and understand them.
Well, between the State Library of Victoria's collection and your obsession, we have a much easier path into some of those extraordinary stories. Fellow Frockery is the name of Kaz's website. The details are up on the Blueprint for Living part of the RN website. I've been talking to the wonderful Kaz Cook. Thank you so much, Kaz.
Hurrah.